So again, welcome everyone, welcome to you all. It's nice to have the feedback of teachers doing non-residentials in here. Just this last weekend, Christine has been offering some teaching during the Saturday and Sunday, and how excited she was with the space and how accommodating and workable it was for her. So it's really nice to hear other teachers come and gloat a little about what we offer. So it is a nice space. So tonight we're going to continue the theme of birthing the heart, and I've called this talk The Complete Practice. But I have a little preamble to the talk, so don't get too concerned that the preamble might feel unapproachable to you. I'll make it approachable as we bring the subject to bear upon the preamble. But the preamble starts with, in about 1980, with my visit to India to see the sage Nisargadatta Maharaj. And sitting in front of him and having his instructions for the few weeks I was there, his instructions were very basic. It was to acknowledge the I am. So I was dressed as a monk, and I felt pretty steady in my practice history, about 5 years at that point, and got a sense of what the I am is. And yet every time I went to examine the I within the am, there wasn't much to be found. And he kept directing us in that way, although he kept claiming that the existence is, that the I am was. So the question that kind of boiled forth for most of us was, the existence can't be disputed, the amness of it, but the conditionality of where we locate and claim reference to that existence wasn't there. And I think many of us have had the experience of just asking ourselves from various points, you know, who am I, or what am I, or what is this, or, and in the moment we ask that question, there may be a glimpse or an instant in which the nothingness of ourselves is understood, that there's nothing there that really catches that question with an answer. And yet, the existence continues. So how is it that we're able to acknowledge the existence, and yet there's no one to be found? This, in its various disguises, is really the spiritual journey. This sense of thingness in life, this sense of object and conditionality, of content, and yet the persistent recognition by some of us that none of this can really be found in substantial and meaningful ways within ourselves as a actual experience of what the eye sees. And yet, so that's the mystery. The mystery is that existence is, and yet I'm not to be found within existence. So what is all this? Because certainly existence is. There's no dispute in that. The I am, as Nisargadatta was pointing to, is a fact. So that is the spiritual quest. That is what the spiritual quest is. And we have to be careful that we don't dilute that spiritual quest, that we constantly come back and refresh that to ourselves. Now, how is it, see again, if there is existence and yet it's not to be found within the conditioned sense of who I believe myself to be, then where is it to be found? Where is existence to be found? I mean, that's a fair question. It's here. Where is it to be? How is it to be discovered? And the problem is that when we start looking at confirming our existence, we look towards the experiences we have of our life. And we miss the context from which those experiences arise. And that's the problem. We're looking in an alternative way to where the answer lies. And so much of the difficulty on the path is reorienting our perception so that we begin to sense where the existence is as opposed to where we assert our perceptions. And so this then is the Buddhist journey, the spiritual journey. It's certainly how the Buddha, I believe, pointed out the journey. Was that he really offered ongoing practices that showed us and disrupted the sense of conclusion about conditions being us. And he did this in our tradition most predominantly through the sense of impermanence or change. So the spiritual question, you might say, is to move from the conditions of what we believe ourselves to be to the existence that doesn't hold those conditions. Okay, so I said this could be a little remote to some of us. Now let me bring it down to the reachable and approachable system it is. There's a story in the Buddhist time of an old man who was too old to go to the Buddha's side, so he sent his young grandson to the Buddha to ask what the Buddha taught. And the first time he went, he said, my grandfather would like to know what you teach. And the Buddha says, I teach sila, I teach ethics, I teach ethical conduct. And so the boy goes back to the old man, he tells the old man, the old man says, well, go ask him if there's anything else he teaches. So the second time the boy goes, he says, yes. The Buddha says, yes, I teach something else. I teach samadhi, steadiness of mind, oneness of mind. So I teach sila and I teach samadhi, and then off again the boy goes and tells his grandfather. The grandfather sends him back the third time, and the third time the Buddha says, yes, I teach wisdom. I teach sila, I teach samadhi, steadiness of mind, I teach wisdom, the understanding of what life is. And for the fourth time, the grandfather says, go see if there's anything else. And the Buddha then answers the young boy saying, no, there's nothing else I teach. Okay, so I want to connect the two threads I just brought up. This sense of existence, this discovery of what we are, what the whole world is, and the three elements of the Buddhist practice, sila, samadhi, and panya. How do those two meet? Because the Buddha is laying out a practice for us. He's laying out a full participation in life in which we are to realize the insubstantiality of existence. So my encouragement tonight is going to be looking at those three words and how those three words actually flesh out the emptiness of where the Buddhist teaching moves. So you get a sense of where this is going? And mostly, we don't organize the teaching in terms of moving in a correct direction. So that's the most important thing, is that we realize that everything the Buddha taught had that as its ultimate objective, was to realize the true nature of what life is. So let's just look at these three words in relationship to that quest. Sila, or ethics. When we think of sila, or ethics, we don't necessarily think of it revealing the emptiness of ourselves. We think of it as something that good boys and girls do, that are a sort of a holdover from our moral training as within our youth. And we think it's the right thing to do, to have some ethical training and conduct, but it doesn't necessarily compute that that's going to show us the emptiness of life. So let's look and see how that actually occurs. So the first thing, when we take on a word like mindfulness, and we let mindfulness just briefly rub us, just touch us, you see, there's something, a transformative quality, that first touch of awareness. There's a softening that's occurring. Something's happening when the first time we ever sit down and establish contact with awareness. And something changes in us. Something begins to be shown to us that we haven't seen before. Some aspect of ourselves is reachable in ways that only books talked about it prior to this first rub of mindfulness. Our heart begins to open. We begin to sense a level of subtlety within us, a level of softness, a direction that we can go instead of the hard knot that we have come from. And this begins to work in relationship to releasing a kind of self-focus that we've had the whole time. That first very gentle rub of mindfulness establishes a way for us to move out of the hardness of heart that has dominated and influenced us since we were young. Now this softening, of course, you can use morality or sila or ethical conduct to do just the opposite. You can use it to make yourself harder, to make your, to should and blame and must yourself into a harder brick than you were before you started. Because certainly none of us live up to the moral imperative that we live by. None of us, all of us have the capacity to shake our finger at ourselves, to hold us in contempt. But that's not where the teaching is going here. The teaching is going towards the softening, towards the opening, towards the releasing of the conditions that have bred our life to be what it has been. And so we have to use it in accordance to the formula of moving from conditionality to existence. We have to use it so that it's compatible with the direction of the teaching. And that's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do because our minds are still very much in control of our journey early on, and our minds are meant to solidify conditions, not to release conditions. And so we're fighting the temptations to be moralistic within our ethics. And we have to be careful again. We don't really, some of it is a lack of trust. We don't, if we let go of the hammer that keeps us tied in and keeps us on the spiritual track and keeps us doing the right thing, we're afraid if we loosen that, all hell's going to break loose. You know, the animal inside of us is going to come out. The id is going to show itself, and the world is going to live in a kind of a, with the savage beast that emerges from us. But it's not true. What happens is your heart becomes just the opposite, really. Something very wonderful comes out of us. Something that we had was unexpected. And so within this softening, this gentleness, there comes a vision of things not being quite so distant from each other, that life is much more communal than separate, the way we thought it was. And so this invites us forward into the journey, into that softening journey of ourselves. And That's the first element of these, of this sense of sila, is that recognition that there's something good within me. There's goodness within me. That I can relax a little with myself and expect that goodness to flourish rather than to be devoured by some ravaged beast inside of me. And so that view that it begins to impart to us is part of the journey of sila, that view of connection. And very gently, as we concede our actions to the softening of our heart, within the softening of our heart, we begin to tune ourselves more and more into that view. And as we violate the precepts, we sense in ourselves that the other is there. And when we move off the path of ethical training, it comes back and asserts its tightness and its control and its hardness. And we can feel that lump in our chest as we venture forth into, you know, distorting our speech or exterminating or lying or whatever we might be doing. But that sense of quiet, as we begin to soften, there is also a gentle sense of quieting that goes on as well. And as we quiet, the world gets organized from within a different perception. And the mind becomes harmonious. And we start loving the sense of harmony within ourselves. The tension of selfishness begins to be seen and intuitively understood when we are selfish, almost by the bodily grip that selfishness has on us. And then the willingness to come back into harmony is simply the releasing of that construct, of the sense of I needing, or us, you know, or the sense of I being a priority above other beings. It feels good to live in harmony. It's a light. It's light. It's an unburdening. And the existence that we sense is behind all of this has zero psychic weight. There's no weight at all to existence. It's only when we are starting to condition a belief of I within that existence that there is the psychic burden of ourselves that we start having a weight. And so as we lighten up, as we move into this sila, into this ethical way of life, we realize that, you know, it feels like we're going back home. We're returning to something that we have forgotten about, that we have we've mistaken within the hardness that we have been practicing. And another beautiful effect of practicing sila, or ethical conduct, in all of its different forms and expressions, and beginning to be more nuanced in what those precepts are aiming towards, and more subtle in the way that we violate some of the selfish temptations we still have, is that we have a less of a sense of a paranoia about us. We aren't lying, so there's no need to turn back and make sure that nobody has found out or discovered the lie we might have said in a different era. And so there's a sense of settledness. And as we settle more and more, there's a growing sense of our place on earth, as I've spoken about many times. Because the mind isn't in movement. It's not disturbed in the same way. It's not wishing to get out of this place to get to some place where I can hide. It's simply settled wherever it is. And it's settled where it is because it lives a life in which it hasn't violated any of the circumstances of life. And so it's very settled within life, very confident within life. And that has a tremendous effect, again, on quietude. So much of our noise in our mind is wishing we were someplace other than where we are for various reasons, but often because we feel disturbed where we are. We feel we've been at odds with life for such a long time that the ramifications, the implication of that is that we always feel kind of out of place with ourselves. Psychologically out of place, that I'm not supposed to be here, nobody likes me here. ethically out of place because we've said something or done something where we might be discovered. But generally, the mind is constantly looking for another alternative than now. And once we have learned to live within accordance of an ethical life, now becomes home. We're not looking for another place to live. It's not that now is special, it's just that there's nowhere else to go. There's no other alternative. That all that other was just an imaginative response to the impulse to leave our skin. But once we live comfortably within our skin, then we live comfortably, period. And so there's this beautiful sense of, and this is a very important point, of a diminished sense of time, the burden of time upon us as our ethics deepens. Because we're not coming up with defenses for each and every response we give or interaction we have. And much of that becomes very clean. And so being less defensive, we're less burdened by the past of our guilt, of our shame, of our regrets. And therefore the past doesn't implode that much upon the present because we don't have that much to think our way through or to feel or work forgiveness through our life any longer. And it's a, that cleaner life, that sense of refresh quality that ethics gives us, settles with us very quietly, very easily, in terms of how much thought we have to produce in order to keep substantiating the reasons why we're here, or what we're doing, or why we did what we did, or the guilt we have, or explaining ourselves, or all of that. You see, it all just quiets down. And so, somebody comes up and says, why did you do this? And you say, I didn't do it. That's it. There's not, you don't need another paragraph on top of that. And they get a lawyer and sue you, and you didn't do it. And that's it. And even though they win the suit and you're out a lot of money or whatever it might be, or you're in jail and you're in a lineup and somebody said you did do it, still inside there's no equivocation. That's it. You're in jail, but you didn't do it. That's it. And now is still now. You just don't get vegetarian food. So this lightness, and being able to, the past is seen as the past. Past is seen as the past. These are not small, insignificant points. This is just living in accordance with less selfishness, from less self-concern. And you don't have to deny the sense of self that's still with us in order to get to that. You just have to live in accordance to the deepest levels of human interaction and the harmony within those interactive qualities. So just naturally killing, stealing, lying, etc., and all of the nuanced and subtlety pieces of that just start dropping away. And when it drops away, so does the need for self-aggrandizement, the need for self-promotion. And it just gets quieter. And where are we going? We haven't gone anything. We've just oriented our life in a different system, within a different way. That's all. And we're much more likable when you're not, because people can feel the energy of of the violence of being unethical, and that there's a welcome mat out in front of you, so to speak. And another quality of sila that's a very important quality is that it acts as a safeguard for exploring other states of mind. So what do I mean by that? If you are genuinely embedded, living within an ethical life, and you have some part of you that still, let's say, lusts or whatever it might be, well, if you know that you're going to live within the relationship you have and you're not going to exploit other people, then you have more freedom to actually look and explore lust. But if you think you might give over to the temptation that lust will offer you, you'll stay away from it. You'll be aversive to it. You won't want anything to do with it. You'll be afraid of it, essentially, and you'll never understand it sufficiently to be able to move on. And this is true for every single component of us. We have to feel safe within ourselves to explore something, and not that if we explore that thing, it's going to take us over. Because exploration is the only way that we can come to terms with a state of mind, not by aversion or turning our back on it. And yet many of us never approach those subjects because we think, for instance, that once we do, we'll be in under its grip and be lost within its energy. But it isn't so. If the heart feels open and available and aligned, then you can bring anything. Let's look at this. And I was talking a few weeks ago about prejudice. Now, you know, that's a word that all of us are like, oh no, I'm not prejudiced. Well, we're all prejudiced in one way or another. And if you realize your heart, our hearts, are pure enough to want to explore that, but and do not want to move into that identification with it, in which we become prejudiced, but I want to explore the residue of the years I've lived within a prejudiced culture, and let me just see this thing, let me look at it. Then we can be finished with prejudice. But we can't be if we are afraid to expose it to ourselves, or we pretend it's not there, or we don't want to look at it, you see, which is much of the culture tries to form ourselves around that with politically right speech, and all that just keeps it all tucked in so that I can't say what I really want to say, and therefore I can't explore what I really need to explore. So you begin to get a sense that this isn't helping anybody, and a mind that really wants to know and clean out the rubbish that's still there has to feel safe within itself to explore, no matter what it is, to explore and to confront those states of mind. And all of this is starting to rebirth the heart, of course. And we haven't done anything, you see. We haven't done anything. We simply conceded our own space over to the space of all beings. Even just taking that vow, just allowing that vow into our heart, starts orienting us in the direction of all beings. And all of this, of course, has a lot to say about our sense of existence and the conditioning that we have formed around that existence, claiming ourselves in relationship to it. So even though we may not have arrived at the conclusion that of selflessness, even if we still continue to be a shadow within ourselves, an unfound shadow, an insubstantial shadow, but it still feels like we're carrying ourselves along within it, it's a very It's a very one-dimensional shadow. It can't convince us in the same way. It doesn't have the power to voice itself in the same way it did when we thought that life was built all around our needs, and we acted from within that intention. And so now we've done is take on this thing of sila, which is, what did the Buddha say? It's one of the three elements of, if you looked at all of what I taught, this is one of the three elements of what I taught. It hasn't pressed on us. It hasn't created an inward tension because we are shaming ourselves into being more ethical. All that tension we have long since seen through. We are simply moving deeper into the sense of heart connection, and that has a one-way direction towards more connection with ourselves and with others. And every time a thought comes up in which we place ourselves above another, we see that as really silliness. Just silliness, really. How could that possibly be true? How could one person have in any conceivable way be special from another? And we haven't even gotten to the other two yet, expressions of the teaching, samadhi and panya, so let's go there. Already we have an orientation for samadhi because our minds are less noisy, we're less resistant inside, we aren't as traumatized by our life and by others' lives imploding upon our own. We have a stability of being and groundedness. That's the definition of samadhi. Mental harmony. Stability and oneness of mind. That steadiness of mind. Now you can see it move with this. You see that this... that one cannot exist without the other. There cannot be samadhi without sila. It took me years to understand that. I thought I could build this ship on my own, do whatever I wanted to do, continue to act individually selfishly, and still ride the ship home. Well, guess what? Doesn't work. Because that stability of attention, that stability of mind, that oneness that is expressing itself now inwardly that we are following in terms of our external actions is beginning to show itself. Because when you look down and you try to find your breath, and the reason you can't find your breath is that you're thinking your way out of the breath, and many of those thoughts have to do with what you're desiring or what you're fearing or what you're afraid of or what you might be or what the implication of you not being on your breath and all of that stuff, which is now settled down sufficiently. Just why? Because we're in our skins. We're living in our skin. And so our focus, our ability to focus, which is one aspect of samadhi but not the full definition, the ability to attend to what it is that's going on around me, it's much easier. Much easier. And the more I attend to what's going on within me, the more I see that opinionation within that attention is irrelevant to what I'm really looking at, I'm releasing more and more of the opinionation of myself. So I'm actually, there's a hole in the balloon of me that's leaking terribly, unfixable. The tire is just about flat, egoically flat. And I'm seeing from my own vantage point, from the sense of samadhi, the stability of mind, in connection with the interconnection of action, body, speech, and mind, I'm seeing the true nature of life. Samadhi is showing me, the stability is showing me. And what it's showing me is the interconnectedness. Well, guess what that reinforces? My actions towards that end. And so he says, this is all I'm teaching. This is it, you see. How accessible could that? You don't have to be a monk or a nun. But you have to incline your mind towards this. If you incline your mind towards self-service, towards self, to your self-advantage, then your life is going to go in the opposite direction. It can't go. It's really up to us. Left turn, you head west. Right turn, you head east. What direction do we want to go? And it's so beautifully reinforced from every perspective as we turn into the direction of connection, because it's all being reinforced by what we're seeing in meditation. But if we turn west and we start meditating through our individual differences, through our selfish needs, the mind is going to be noisy. You're going to be full of ambiguity, because you're honoring and imagining something that is not true. And there won't be any settledness, because once you've established the I thought is the main focus and reason for your life, the I thought really consumes all other thoughts and becomes loud, louder as your life progresses. But if you want to be quiet, if you want to know interconnection, if you want to just see, then we have to do it from our actions as well as from the meditation. We have to commit our life towards that end, towards connecting, towards making this a physically real journey, not an imaginative, make-believe, wish-I-could journey. And we can all do that. This is very reachable. And even though I started from existence conditionality to the sense of existence, when you're in line through ethical conduct, through stability of attention, the panya, the wisdom of actually seeing life. Not from what we want it to be, because that's a selfish act. When we invite what we want to be upon what is actually occurring, we begin to feel the sense of even that level of selfishness. It's taking us all the way down through the layers of the onion. And even making a demand upon something as big as existence itself, and setting ourselves in opposition to this moment because it doesn't fit our needs, at some point in our practice, makes no sense at all to do. It makes no sense in whatever direction we ponder it, because that's what's happening, and to argue against what is happening is foolish. But also, because who are we to demand life to turn in favor of the direction I want it to take? And our sila has shown us that. And our steadiness of attention has confirmed that. And our wisdom has accessed that truth. Because wisdom is a byproduct of steadiness, of attention. And if our attention is rocky and if our attention is just moving from one thought to another, each thought, if you look at each thought, it all centers back on us. So if we're just living from one thought to another, like some kind of jungle gym, from one bar to the next, then we're staying above ground, swinging ourselves through the air of our thinking. Never landing, never being, never confirming, never steady, never open, never connected. And that's a life of conditionality, by definition. It's a life of thinking. It's a life of believing what is not true. It's a life of movement. You can hear it in the arm swinging to the next bar. But landing, confirming, steadying, presence, living within ourselves, living integritous, in alignment with ourselves, within what we know, never pretending we don't know what we don't know, that we know what we don't know. Immediately it drops down. Immediately, you can feel it in the room. Immediately we drop down to a recognizable place. Immediately there's an orientation. Immediately there is a seeing and an understanding and a confirming, a heart confirmation. And there's nothing like a heart confirmation. That's why you're all in this room, is that your hearts have been confirmed. You know what is being said is the truth. This is not fiction. This is not a film. And you know how you've been living up until this point, or much of the way that we've been living up until this point, has not aligned you to that sense of self-affirmation. So enough of that. This is, if we have gone this far and we're still not convinced, I don't know if there's any hope. We have got to just give ourselves over. You just go with it. Because the alternative is the crisis that's upon us. Sila. Confidence of being. Samadhi, steadiness of mind. Looking, seeing, quietness of mind, mental harmony, not moving with every spurious thought, and the penetrating wisdom of that seeing, of the knowing, of the direct knowing for ourselves. No wonder the Buddha said it was his entire teaching. What else was he going to say? Where else was he going to point? He'd said it all. Okay. Let us sit for a minute if we could. So sit with yourself. Ask yourself that reflective question. What's back here? And see if there's anything but existence. This is beautiful. It's not that we're not going to lose our existence. Existence is. Nisargadatta said, "I am." That was his statement of existence. But everything else that we build upon that. every weighted opinion, every detail of resistance and struggle. Existence doesn't hold. Only our mind's labor and burden holds it. And so we have to find our way out of that, back to existence itself, back to just being. Okay, so if you have any questions or comments, I'd be happy to respond if I can. So I'm taking this series, I'll just talk for a second. I'm taking this series of the heart and just showing it from different perspectives. You see? So now the perspective of conduct, this perspective of wisdom, this perspective of samadhi. How does the heart, how do we birth the heart? You see? And as all of these different factors start playing into our life, you will hear that it's less struggle, not more struggle, that we want to apply. It's more relaxed. We want to be more relaxed, not less relaxed. We don't want to be tense. We don't want to meet whatever's occurring with attention. That has never been said in this series. We want to align ourselves up to whatever it is around. Living within our wisdom, within what our understanding, doing what we feel is appropriate given that understanding, and learning all along the way so that we move deeper into that understanding. This is why I teach in community. I teach in community because I think you can miss the point if you think that some reserved and very special environment holds the secret to your life's success as a spiritual seeker. It doesn't. Every moment holds that success. Every moment is an attempt to just reach it, to just live within it, to come home once more. So any questions or comments from anyone? Did I shock you into quiet? Perhaps I missed. Yes, Ling.
A while ago, you were talking about that sense of belonging last month. And I did have an experience where I felt so very grounded and to that very deep connection to that moment. To use one of your words, is that you feel something has landed. And ever since, I think very subtly, I longed with that experience. And then it dawned on me today that sense is always with me. It was my own perception that was divided.
Very good, Ling. Very good. So she said that she had a sense of belonging that she thought was temporary, and over time it has shown her that it's always back there, and that she's misplacing that belonging from time to time, or misperceiving it. You know, there's a book out, and I think it's by Utejaniya, that says the defilements are visitors are just passing through. Something like that. Do you know that? Is that right? Something like that. Anyway, so I slightly contest that title. Not that it's wrong, but I would say every state of mind is a visitor just passing through. Right? The mind itself is a visitation upon awareness. Now, when you're touching awareness and not conceding over to whatever the mind is telling you, because if you concede it over to what the mind is telling you, that's just a fabricated construction of what your memory holds and what your fears are and what your desires are, and all of that builds upon what the mind is saying in that state of mind and on and on. So if you concede your energy to what the mind is saying, you always feel like belonging is just ahead of you, after you've accomplished something, after you've done something, after you've settled more, after you're more content, after you have the seven factors of enlightenment, then you can settle. Right? But you can settle with an awareness so that you're the sky letting the clouds pass through rather than following each cloud hoping that the sky clears. Okay, so that's a different... Now you're the sky, so you're already settled. Now you already belong. And whatever the clouds are that come through it are of no real relevance to the sky. It stays the same, doesn't it? This is where the context becomes more important than the content. As I mentioned, you know, when we look into ourselves and we don't see anything, we do see existence, but we don't know what existence looks like. We're looking for it in a different way, something, you know, that has content. But existence doesn't have content any more than the sky has content. It's just awareness. But there is a way to acknowledge that awareness. And once we do acknowledge that awareness and we have less investment in the content, then you'll feel a sense of belonging. That'll be the first thing that'll come. It's like, oh God, I'm at home. I'm at home. Many people, the first utterance is that. How could I have missed this? It's so obvious. Those are the exclamations from it. So when we get quiet together as a group, we are honoring in that moment the context, not the content. If you think the absence of content is what makes it special, you're missing the point of quiet. Quiet, yes, it doesn't have content, but that's not the point. The point is that it holds something else that we miss because we say, oh, this is so quiet. As soon as you claim it to be that, then the absence of content is just asserting more content. And I don't know if you're following all this, but it actually does make sense. You see, quiet is just... it's awareness. That's what quiet is. It's the context out of which all things move, through which all things move. Yes. Yes. It's where all aliveness is. That's right. It's the seat. It's where everything is.
Would you ever use
the everlasting life? I think, didn't Jesus say that? Or a Christian, right?
I just want to get that same perspective from a grounded being. Or would that, because there's also a sense that there is no ground. But
yes, it holds everything without contesting anything. And so from the sense of me individually, That's a part of the perception within the context. There's groundedness of being. Right? Okay. Thank you all.